I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deal in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. And my guests today are Brandon Dom and Brian Pollan, co-owners of Brooklyn Kura, the very first sake brewery in New York, which opened in 2017 at the Industry City in Brooklyn, New York. They joined us on episode 105 in December 2017 and episode 178 in November 2018, and discussed the unique concept of the Brooklyn Kura and how they naturally incorporate the spirit of traditional Japanese sake making into their craft sake style. So, and since then, Brooklyn Kura has been growing successfully, and some of our listeners may have seen its sake labels at Japanese and non-Japanese restaurants, as well as local retailers. And Brian and Brandon have joined us today to discuss their newly expanded sake brewery, along with how their sake production has not changed since they opened the brewery 6 years ago, their collaborations with Japanese sake breweries, including the premier brand Hakkaisan, the future of American craft sake industry, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We truly appreciate your feedback. Now let's start a conversation with Brian Pollan and Brandon Dom. Hello, Brian. Hello, Brandon. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks for having us back.
All right. So I really have to say first, congratulations. This is such a big 6 years of progress, and you got a new, bigger sake brewery, so we'll discuss later.
Yeah, we've been very, very lucky and have had incredible support from the sake industry and community to make the progress we have.
Mm. So this is Brian. And you guys are always so modest, and that's another reason you've been so successful too. So for listeners who have not listened to episode 105 in December 2017 and episode 178 in November 2018, tell us about your background and how did you get into sake and end up working together to build a great sake brewery in Brooklyn?
Go for it, Brandon.
All right. Well, my background is I'm a research scientist. And I've always had an interest in fermentation. And then when I met Brian for the first time in Japan. We had a chance to travel around Japan for the first time. And I think we'd both been to a lot of wineries and breweries, but walking into a traditional sake brewery in Japan was a new experience for us. It was different than just drinking sake here in the States, you know, seeing how it's done, you know, smelling the smells there, and just seeing everyone putting a batch together, I think, had a big impact on us. So we left with that memory and continued talking about it and eventually changed our careers and then we're sake makers now.
Mm. Right. Yeah. So the by the way, listeners. So Brandon used to create cancer drugs, and now he's making something edible.
Yep. What a different kind of drug.
That's true. That is true. Good drug. All right. Sorry. So Brian.
Oh, no, not a problem. Brian Poland, my life before this, I used to run a product and technology organization for American Express. And as Brandon mentioned, I mean, just the impact of seeing a functioning brewery in Japan drove us to start thinking about how do we make sake at home just for fun or our own personal joy. And then seeing the quality we were able to produce at home gave us the confidence to raise the money and put the plan together and leave our jobs to start this adventure.
Mm, right. Yeah, I always have a good impression about how complimentary you guys are personally and, you know, the business background. And I totally understand why you came such a long way. So, but what a big change. And one trip to Japan changed the whole thing in your life. So that's exciting. Maybe you can write a book sometime.
Okay. We got work to do right now. Too much work.
Right, that's true. So, and you opened Brooklyn Kura in 2017. So what is the concept of Brooklyn Kura? And is there any shift in the concept since the opening to now?
So really, I mean, we've always set out to do one basic thing, which is to produce the best quality sake that we can. We think fundamentally that sake is delicious and that the more people have local access to it, the more people will recognize that. And as a result, the better for both ourselves as a company and the broader sake industry. And that kind of ethos or mantra or so, like basic goal has not changed. In fact, actually, we've really refocused on it in terms of production and the way we communicate our sakes with our new tap room and our sake study center.
Mm, right. Yeah, we discussed the Sake Study Center as well later. How do you, what's your philosophy of sake making?
I think one of the things we're also trying to do is just make sake much more familiar to Americans. It seems like sake has been trying to be a thing in the United States and elsewhere outside of Japan for a long time. And it's confusing for Americans who can't speak or read Japanese to select a bottle. And so we're kind of, you know, we're basically copying what beer and wine did in the United States. Beer and wine were things from France and Germany, until Americans started making it, and making it locally and having like a local pub or a local winery. And that just made it much more familiar for Americans and safer to try new things. So we use, you know, we're an American sake brewer. We use American grown rice. We use the water from Brooklyn, and we present our sake without any unnecessary Japanese words or language. And I think our tap room really feels approachable and comfortable. Like it's like a beer bar or a wine bar.
Right. So you really hit the important point because I think it used to be before you opened the Brooklyn Kura, Japanese sake still needed kind of interpretation through Japanese restaurants mainly. And you made the sake as something very Brooklyn cool. And I started to see, you know, I see your labels in retail shops and restaurants, but it's not sake from the past from Japan to here. It's something cool to drink. And I really think one of the biggest achievements you guys created was positioning of Japanese sake. It's something cool. It's not from the past or history. It's something, it's just delicious and cool to drink, and also you respect the tradition. So, yeah, I'm so glad you guys decided to switch your careers and do something, this amazing thing.
We are most of the time, too. Most of the time.
Okay. So what do you call your style of sake?
I think, you know, as sake making is growing outside of Japan, people are approaching it from all different directions. you know, there's some people who are doing really experimental stuff or kind of beer fusion or like fruit fusion kind of drinks. And we, you know, we really wanted to present to consumers, many who are first time drinkers of sake, like an accurate representation of what sake is. Mm-hmm. So we tend to go heavily on the traditional style of sake.
And that's also because of the market that we operate in, right? So in addition to kind of making a traditional style of sake, I mean, New York City is one of the most vibrant like sake markets in the world, with the best breweries in Japan distributing their products to New York. And so in order for us to have like compelling conversations with retailers and restaurants, we really need to be able to produce a world-class quality of sake in a traditional way. And in doing so, get the confidence of the industry, their support, and eventually kind of the placements we need to survive as a business.
I think that's very important because like for sushi, California rolls and spicy rolls made sushi more known and available for spending decades. But Japanese sake industry, traditional industry, has been shrinking so fast. Like to merely like 50 years from 4,000 kuras, now only around thousands operating. So we don't have time. So you're presenting the nature and the essence of traditional Japanese sake in a very approachable way. So I think I would put your style of sake as traditional and explore something new, like new yeast, you know, new elements, and some sometimes you do playful production we discussed in the past episodes. So, yeah. So do you think you're going to maintain that traditional style of sake along with something more creative?
I mean, I think we enjoy, you know, sort of doing all things. You know, we have one other thing we're trying to do is to show people that sake isn't just one thing, that there is, you know, a spectrum of different styles of sake, that they taste different, that they smell different, that you can drink some cold, some warm. So, you know, we have like taps in our tap room. And it's really, we're saying, you know, it's as varied, it's more subtle, but it's as varied as like, you know, having a stout or an IPA or a Pilsner. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more than one thing, and there's a lot to learn about, and we're trying to intrigue people with that.
Right. And, based on your scientific mindset, I think you're not trying to be playful or like creative. You just want to explore what, you know, yeast and the live animals can do to improve the quality and taste.
Yeah. And I mean, also, I think, you know, we in production, we do like to have fun. If it's, you know, we do small batches, and we think of different concepts and stories to tell about it. So we keep it interesting for ourselves as well.
Right. Okay. So, so speaking of your sake, you know, our listeners who have not tasted your sake. So what are your signature sake, and what do you offer besides them at the tap room?
Brian?
So to Brandon's point, we make a range of things because that's what keeps us interested. But in general, to now, we've really focused our attention on nama sake. So these are unpressed pasteurized sakes that have a little bit more limited distribution. They are kind of fresh tasting, floral and delicious, and they're very accessible. And you can find those sakes around New York and around New York Metro. We've also, over the past 5 years, developed a range of limited release sakes that tell the story that we just described, which will range from a daikinjo we call Catskills, which is which is beautiful and embodies the water and is very traditional style, all the way through to our Occidental, which is a traditionally made Junmai that's lightly dry hop. So those have been kind of the range of our products and our intention to now. As we develop into this new brewery, we're going to have more tools at our disposal, which doesn't mean we'll change kind of the essence of what we do or the way we make sake fundamentally, but allow us to offer products that maybe have a little bit more shelf life. So maybe double pasteurized, like the sakes that we import from Japan. And as a result, they'll be able to live more freely around the world in kind of ambient temperature and in a way that, that retailers and restaurants are accustomed to caring for sake as a product.
Mm, right. Okay. So who is drinking your sake? You now have a wide distribution to retail shops and restaurants. So I'm very curious who's drinking Pukenkura sake.
It's really a broad range of people. There's no specific age group. It's people who have an affinity for Japan or for fermentation or for the experience of visiting a local brewery, taproom, winery. And so there's many people who have experienced sake for the first time. And we're driven just out of curiosity, are people who are your world's experts that have been operating breweries in Japan for 10 years that are visiting New York to explore the market and coming to see what we're up to. So in our tap room, I mean, all of those audiences are we think about in terms of the experience and the offerings we have available. And that's also true in retailers. We have the kind of the Brooklyn natural wine retailers. And then we also have the more traditional retailers that are starting their sake selection for the first time and very interested in offering something local. That's also true with the restaurants we work with. Some of them are progressive, farm-to-table, Michelin-star restaurants. And then on the other side, there are these traditional Japanese-owned ramen spots that carry our products. So there's no simple answer. I think ultimately it's people who have the same passions we do, which is for like quality products that are made with care and intention, that have some connection to their passions or interests, and are delicious. And so that's really, I mean, the things we try and achieve.
Right. Yeah, again, since you guys started to grow, I started to see Japanese sake, your label and even not your label. I think the market is more, it's okay to have Japanese sake in non-Japanese restaurants, and which is cool because Japanese sake is very friendly with almost any kinds of food. So I think you are inspiring the whole consumer market as well.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss Pukenkura's newly expanded facilities and its fascinating collaborations with other sake and non-sake breweries. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network on HRN. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama. My guest today is Brandon Dong and Brian Pollen, co-owners of Pukenkura and the very first sake brewery in New York, which opened in 2017 at Industry City in Brooklyn, New York. Okay, So after the tremendous success over the last 6 years, you have expanded your production facilities also in the industry city in Brooklyn. So could you tell us what is new in the new facilities?
Well, I mean, I'll start with our the production side. So we have a significantly larger production facility, and we have new, better equipment. I think as our skill at sake making has grown, we've made better sake, but it's also very difficult to make sake on a homebrew scale where we started off. And then we had sort of an intermediate practice space. And then we went into our first real brewery, and at each point where the scale grew, I think our quality improved. And now we have, we thought about kind of the machines and things we need to continue that. So now we have a way to handle our rice to wash it and soak it and steam it on a larger scale and then quickly cool it. What we've been doing in our first facility is we've just had to lay out the rice and let it cool, which is difficult in New York in August. So now we can like really kind of dial in exactly what we want. We have better temperature control. We have better way to clean things. A newer system for our koji growing. So that's all kind of coming together right now. We've been putting that together for the last year, and we're getting close to starting to make some big batches.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many times bigger is the new facility compared to the old one?
What is that in square feet, Brian? How many times bigger is it?
So we're in our original space is around 3,500 square feet. Our new space is around 20,000 square feet, but that's broken. That's broken up into our new tap room, which is around twice as large. We have some offices and laboratory production offices and offices in the space. We were able to be very intentional. Now we've had to make some revisions to the original plans around this space because just post COVID and during COVID, the costs of raw materials and the impact on supply chain and logistics put a lot of pressure on our ability to kind of build the facility that we originally planned. But because of the partnership we have with Industry City, the great contractor that we work with called MNC, and then just a partnership with Hankai-san, we were able to kind of focus and take the best aspects of our ideal brewery and execute on them in our current space. So it's much larger from a production capacity perspective. I mean, we're around 5 to 10 times the capacity in the new facility, but we will be growing into that capacity as we develop new products and new markets and begin exporting, et cetera, just driving demand. And then also as we begin doing things like making sake for other people in the form of collaboration and or to support their own brands and needs as they want to also have an impact on the industry in the U.S.
Mm, wow, that sounds very exciting. Well, let's talk also about this educational program you mentioned earlier. So you offer extensive educational programs for both industry professionals and the public at your new facilities. And the space is called the Sake Studies Center at Brooklyn Kura. So what are you trying to achieve through these educational programs?
Yeah, so first and foremost, Timothy Sullivan joined our team as the director of education of the Sake Study Center. Simultaneously, he is also the global brand ambassador of our strategic investment partner, Hankai-san. And really, we all think that one of the fundamental challenges that sake has and obstacles to becoming a global beverage is around education. And so not just consumer education, but also industry education, which ranges from kind of distributors and their professionals that are out there kind of making placements, all the way through retailers and restaurants and how they talk about and describe sake and promote sake in their everyday interactions with customers. And so the Sake Study Center is really geared to kind of give us a platform to educate not just about Brooklyn Kura, but about the broader industry and other producers across the spectrum, across the supply chain. And we've had our first Sake 101 last week. We have our first Sake server certification on December 4th. We've had a lot of interest from retailers and restaurants around the process and the offerings. And it just feels like, because we have some additional time and resources, the right thing to invest in on behalf of the industry, really. So we're launching events with the National Tax Authority from Japan. We're working with the Japanese consulate and consulate general and the embassy. I mean, we've been very lucky, and the education center, the Sake Study Center, is really, I mean, at the heart of what we want to do in this next phase of our business.
Wow. So you cover all the participants of this whole sake industry from even Japan. So, well, that's very hopeful. And also, of course, Timothy Sullivan is kind of as important as now, and John Gontner, who has influenced the sake industry outside of Japan. So, yeah, Timothy Sullivan is such a great person and a great teacher, experienced, and his Sake Revolution podcast is so funny. It's like a Japanese manzai, kind of, right? So, yeah, this is awesome. So what kind of programs? I see the sakestudiescenter.com website, the courses. So one is Introduction to Sake, I'd assume this is to consumers. And there's another one, Sake Server Certification.
Exactly. So we will be launching, these are the programs that will be available. Now, Timothy is spending a lot of his time thinking about the programs that we will launch and the partnerships that we'll launch in the near future. But there will be a combination of in-person educational opportunities at the brewery. And there will also be online courses, including the Sake Server Certification and Sake 101, for folks that aren't fortunate enough to have access to the brewery and can't make that trip. So we will be talking about the Sake Study Center more and the programming more as we develop new offerings. But in the meantime, for retailers and restaurants that are interested in a focused understanding of the service and history of sake and the basics around the methods used to produce it, feel free to reach out, and we'd love to host you at one of these programs.
Right. So listeners, if you're interested, that's www.sakestudiescenter.com. Yeah. So it sounds like you created a kind of community or the cross point for everybody who wants to know more about sake and taste, appreciate sake, and want to help people to appreciate sake. So I think it sounds like a school name, but it's not. It's more like a community you just have built and offers in even a bigger community, connecting all those.
Yeah, so we host Michael Tremblay and his Sake Scholars Program, and we host John Gottner and his Advanced Sake Professional Program. I mean, we want to host the Sake School of America. We really want all educators to have access to the New York market and be able to use our center as a platform for their programs as well. So we're really trying to be like community members, active community members, because we believe fundamentally that's what it's going to take for this industry to kind of transition to where we all want it to be.
Right. It's almost like a bridge. You're bridging traditional Japanese sake culture and the global potential, bigger consumer and the professional sake community, which I think is very important, because physically you have this space, new beautiful space, and you are I think everybody's having fun doing it. So yeah, keep me posted. I'm very curious about this. Right. So on top of it, you have worked with traditional sake breweries in the past and have built great relationships. So maybe you can give us some examples and how you have worked with those Japanese people and running sake breweries.
You want me to go, Brandon?
Go ahead.
We like to see each other because we're very good at visual cues. I mean, it's hard to even describe the number of breweries who, even if there haven't been active collaborations, have come to visit us and talk to us about their process with respect to ours and shared their insights, which has helped advance our abilities and relationships with respect to making sake. But that's fundamental. In addition to collaborations, active collaborations with companies, breweries that are doing very well at advocating for sake, like Nambu Bijin, we also were able to do something very special, and that's partner with a storied century-old brewery from Niigata called Hakai-san. And Hakai-san is our strategic investor and partner in this new brewery and the future of Brooklyn Kura. And we are working together on many different fronts. But I think the remarkable thing is that a traditional Japanese company had the confidence in us to kind of lay the foundation for a very impactful moment on sake in the U.S. And this facility is a reflection of that. It's hard to capture all the relationships and people who have supported us and have lent their time and energy to our success. But the culmination of that has really been this partnership with Hakai-san and our ability to enter this next stage in our brewery.
Mm. So what kind of actual collaborations are you planning with Hakai-san?
Well, I mean, I'll talk from the production side. They've been advising us on just the planning of the brewery, the equipment. Going from the scale that we're at to this new scale is a challenge, and they're already at that scale and larger. So they bring a tremendous amount of knowledge. That's going to be great for us. They're also have a few brewers that are going to come out helping us work at this new scale. I think our sake, you know, is people are still going to recognize it as Brooklyn Kura. It's going to stay the same, but it's becoming collaborative. You know, we learned on our own. We're not that old. And now we're working with people with, you know, between them with hundreds of years of knowledge. So I'm excited to see, you know, what this fusion ends up producing.
Interesting, right? Because Hakai-san in Niigata, Niigata is really, the big area of sake production. But they have really a big open-minded, I would say, attitude or strategy, having Timothy Sullivan, like 2 full years as a trainer. And they are open-minded. Some breweries are very closed. They try not to have anybody from outside the country. But I think Hakai-san has been very forward-minded and global-minded. There's a brewery, so that's why we see, many Japanese restaurants in this country or abroad, Hakai-san label is very popular, and of course, the sake is really a premium, high quality. So, but I had to say, though, they are looking at Brooklyn Kura as kind of the stage to stay more global or to be more global, because I think it's very mutual in terms of which part can help.
Think about it. I mean, whether it be this kind of production collaboration, I mean, it's very important to us to kind of maintain our identity and independence and kind of the style and range of products that we make. But avoiding obvious mistakes and kind of leveraging their expertise is critical. Beyond that, I mean, how do we sell products together? How do we think about positioning a new company and brewery like ours with respect to a century-old brewery that make very, very different products than we do? How do we develop new markets? How do we think about Brooklyn Kura in Japan, right, in the context of traditional breweries for export? So there's a range of different things that we discuss regularly in addition to production. And it's just been really rewarding. There's a large cultural gap often, and it's just the strength of the partnership and the culture of trust that allows us to work together effectively and efficiently. And it's a pretty remarkable thing.
Right. So I thought when you guys opened this Kura, I thought there's going to be a division between traditional Japanese breweries industry and an American or non-Japanese. But then instead of it, you're creating some kind of culture to collaborate, and the whole sake industry as one unit growing globally, and also that growth abroad is just really inspiring Japanese domestic market, so which is amazing. And I think what you guys are doing is probably more than you think you're doing. So I'm so glad you went to the Japanese wedding trip that you met 2013 or something, like a long time ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah. Right. So that one trip changed the whole maybe sake industry. All right. So this is interesting. So your collaborations are not limited to Japanese partners. For example, you created a fascinating beverage called Oishii Cider with the famed New York winery and cider maker, Wolfer Estate in Long Island. So what is Oishii Cider, and what is your motivation to work with a non-sake producing partner?
Yeah, I mean, that came out of my interest in seeing sake yeast in different beverages. So sake yeast is Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It's this yeast is used in beer, wine, and sake, but they're all sort of on three slightly different branches. And they have been, you know, selected by humans over hundreds or thousands of years in different parts of the world. And I just think, you know, sake yeast has its own unique characteristics. It's a shockingly good at fermenting at cold temperatures. It gives different aromas. So I'm just very interested in seeing sake yeast used in different beverages. Through different wine folks, I was able to connect with Wolfer and say, hey, what do you think about first we were thinking about a wine with sake yeast, but Roman really wanted to do cider with it. So we were hopeful that it would create some new kinds of aromas and a unique kind of cider, and I think it really did.
Yes, it was. So I got a chance to speak to the winemaker Roman Roth and cider maker, of course, and his wine is very ingredient driven, very clean, and very honest to the ingredients. And I really never enjoyed cider itself in the past, like as much as I tried this Oishii Cider. It's very subtle but deep and dangerously smooth. And I think he's creating the next batch right now. I think it's coming to the market sometime soon. So I'm really waiting for the Oishii Cider this year again. So, okay. And so this is a very exciting time for American sake industry, as we see dozens of craft sake breweries in the country, and Brooklyn Kura has been a strong force to lead and push the prosperity of the industry. So how do you predict the future of American sake, and especially now Dasai Blue from Dasai opened American brewery upstate New York? So the things are happening. So what's your prediction?
I would say that as long as, so a good example of the progress that's being made is we had a Sake Stakeholder Summit in Washington, D.C., led by the Sake Brewers Association of North America, and a huge range of industry professionals came out to participate and discuss the future of the industry. And there feels to be a lot of like collective momentum around discussing opportunities and making projections about where we want the industry to be and how what is required for us to get there. But ultimately, I think that collected effort is going to result in more investment in the domestic market, in the U.S. market, but also in the international market, which will hopefully drive demand, which will result in kind of greater opportunities for Japanese breweries to sell their products around the globe and companies like ours to begin to gain success and make further investment to have an increasingly large impact. Companies like Asahi Shuzo opening up a facility in Hyde Park next to the CIA and all the talent and training that goes on there is only positive for our industry. The more young restaurant and industry professionals that gain familiarity with sake production and its wonderful interactions with food and just moments in your life that are joyous, the more of those professionals that are going to enter into the world with that knowledge and influence what their restaurants and retail shops do and order and place on the menu. So, I mean, we're in an echo chamber, which is clear, but we're very bullish that we can have an impact on the international market based on what we're doing and companies like Asahi Shuzo and Hakai-san are doing. At the same time, we're hopeful that impact kind of reflects back on Japan, which also needs to invest in the domestic sake market to support these 1,000 breweries that are dependent on it today for their success.
Right. Yeah, interesting. And Shinobu Kato of Kato Sake Works, which is one of the three New York sake breweries, when I went to his brewery, it's a new, he expanded his brewery too. And it was, I thought, I just almost passed by because it looked like kind of cocktail bar or craft beer bar instead of a sake bar because people are sitting as drinking drinks, not Japanese sake. It's the part of the community that's drinking good stuff. So, yeah, I think something's changing very quickly in a very, very happy way in America. I see that Japanese sake breweries are sometimes inspired by wine industry or, you know, craft sake, craft beer industry. So do you think you guys are going to kind of inspire Japanese traditional breweries too in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think we you know, people are definitely aware of us in Japan. I think they're excited to see people outside of Japan making sake because it, you know, it's if they're makers, it's other people, you know, being passionate about what they're passionate about. But also sake's been on the decline in Japan, and so they see new markets opening up. And you know, we've definitely interacted with different breweries. We've had some breweries kind of do a little homages to us and make some sake's based on kind of the concepts that we're doing. So it's very flattering.
Right. Well, I think there are many reasons why Japanese sake industry, domestic industry is shrinking because the generation change. My father's generation drinking a lot of sake and corporate setting too. But, you know, the generation shifted and then the younger generation do not drink alcohol. I think it's a global trend. And also, I mean, it's hard to succeed sake breweries. It's already down to around 1,000 breweries because it's a hard work. So it's not that sake is not delicious or unpopular. It's just the whole market is changing. So if you create a cool trend like you guys doing outside of Japan, I think it's going to be a good thing. Younger generations will think, oh, wow, that's really cool. Maybe we should drink sake. And that's my hope. And I think you're creating that, you know, wave of positive change. So I really hope everybody's going to do something more interesting, keep doing it, and inspire Japanese whole market of consumers. So What are your plans and dreams other than sitting down at the new brewery?
I mean, this really is kind of a dream. I mean, it oftentimes is very challenging and practically difficult. I mean, I won't speak for Brandon, but I think we both genuinely enjoy our lives in Brooklyn, and kind of being a part of something that's having an impact beyond the immediate company that we've created. And so I think as long as we can create a healthy business and continue to have a positive impact and meet some of the exceptional people that we're meeting on a regular basis, I think at least for me, and I wouldn't imagine Brandon to be that much different. I mean, I think we're living like a dream in many respects. It's been a very rich kind of intellectual and cultural process to get us to this point. And I think the next phase will require even more thinking, planning, and preparation, but can have a much broader impact.
And more people involved, and people are going to have fun with you guys. So anything to add, Brandon?
I mean, just I'm very excited to work on this new scale. I mean, we spent a long time planning this out. I mean, there's a lot of different pieces. It's, you know, you think sake brewing is just putting rice in a tank, but like I'm like a much better electrician now, you know, and a plumber. And I've just, you know, been on Zoom calls for the last 2 years with Hakai-san production, just discussing all the things we need to do to, you know, make great sake that's going to last in the bottle and start shipping it around the world. So I'm happy about the work that we've done, but I'm really looking forward to, you know, putting sake out in the world that you know, people will think of in the same way of some of the best Japanese sakes.
Mm. Right. So, Brian, you want to say something? So I interrupted you.
Oh, I was just going to say, BD, what do you want to add? So, no, you did.
Okay.
You're the professional and you did it perfectly. So my apologies.
Yeah, that's the team. I'm sure our listeners wants to visit your new tap room. So what's the operation hours and what we can taste there?
Yeah, I mean, first I'd love to thank the team. I mean, we have this incredibly talented general manager named Hadley Smith who comes to us from some popular restaurants in the city. And we have a new kind of shochu cocktail program here, led by our bar manager, Kyle Davis. I mean, some good folk coming in. But we have a more, interesting food menu that was developed by our friends at Brooklyn Larder. We have our sakes, of course, are the feature and focus. We're able to offer kind of sakes made by our friends, including Hakai-san, in addition to the shochu cocktail program. We're open Thursday through Sunday, Thursday and Friday from 4 to 9, Saturday and Sunday from 12 to 9. But we're also doing more like public tours, which you can register for online, semi-private events, some more private events, and the educational center. So it's a pretty comprehensive set of programs. In addition to having a stage and live music, I mean, we're really trying to lean into, as you've described, the community aspect of our space, featuring our sakes, but also not limiting the experience to them, which has been a lot of fun.
Mm, right. And like you said earlier, Industry City is a good place and it is a home to restaurants, retailers, and many other fun shops. And it's really worth the trouble. And I think you really found the right place at the right time. And now you have a bigger space. So it's very exciting. Right. So, so where can we find your updates online and on social media?
So you can follow us at Brooklyn Kura on Instagram, and we have both www.brooklynkura.com and www.sakestudiescenter.com as resources for folks interested in learning more about what we do. We have subscription service for folks that are interested in experiencing our limited releases throughout the year, which we don't produce much of, and it's a special way for us to interact and engage our best customers directly. And then they can call us anytime. I mean, we pick up and respond to emails really with the goal to spread the love for sake.
Mm, awesome. Right. So again, congratulations and good luck. And you have to keep dreaming for us.
Thank you for your support and Thanks. For always giving us an opportunity to talk about what we're doing.
I look forward to, yeah, another conversation sometime in the near future. So thanks for joining us today, Brian Brandon.
Thank you.
Thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Amin Spenjan, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen. Thank you.